Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto.
And who are we talking to today, Daisy?
Today we're talking to Catherine D. She has been writing about internet culture as Default Friend, which is her Twitter username since 2018, and under her government name. And if you can believe it, she actually wrote the very first article about femcels, an internet subculture that is still very relevant today. She's also a huge fan of Art Bell. I'm not sure if that will come up today, but we've been mutuals for a really long time, and I'm excited to talk to her.
Yeah, nice. Me too. Before she gets here, I want to say I had the best, well, maybe not. I had one of the top three museum-going experiences of my life this weekend.
Tell me everything.
It was the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia.
So nice.
I'd never been, and I was just there visiting a friend with a couple other friends for the weekend, and I had never heard of it. And my one friend was like, oh, we have to go. He got us tickets. It's like the exact opposite of like you go to the Met and you go upstairs to where they have all these like some of them great old paintings, but there's also so much slop. It's like the opposite of that, where it's like so insanely curated, where like the, you know, the Renoirs themselves, amazing, whatever. But just like the way it's hung and like how this echoes that on that wall. And it's just like, it's mind blowing. Anyways, I could probably talk a lot more about that, but Catherine is here.
So we're going to ask her if she's been to the Barnes. She lives in Chicago, so.
No, well, that's not Philadelphia, but.
No, it's not.
Hey,
Catherine. Hey, so we were just talking about the Barnes in Philly, like the art museum, which, so I would put the Barnes in the same category as like Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum
Boston. Don't know what that is.
Well, read up, but you're in for a treat. Hit that Wikipedia page.
I'm going to not read it. You know, it's one of those, maybe that's something that can be a surprise. You know, I don't need to read the review of the movie before.
It's not about the review. It's about the fact that the hugest art heist of all time was there and it's unsolved.
Okay. So what is there anything there? What's there to see?
I mean, oh yeah, yeah. So because of what it is, it's just like one wealthy person's curated collection. Mm-hmm. And then I would also say Peggy Guggenheim collection in Venice, I put in the same category. Okay. And then in New York, the Frick. The problem
I've actually never been to the Frick. Living in New York, I've actually never been to the Frick. Well, it's closed the past few years.
Yes. When it reopens, here, maybe we could do a Tasteland, Tasteland field trip. But so anyway, long way of saying, like, Catherine, I know that you're in Chicago. The Art Institute of Chicago is kind of the bigger museum equivalent. But is there any smaller collection art museum in Chicago that you feel like kind of falls into this category?
There has to be. I mean, I there definitely is. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I know.
It's totally fine.
I know that it. I mean, we have so many museums. Yeah, that's, I feel like there has to be something near the University of Chicago that fits this description, like some sort of curated library or something.
I love college art museums. I feel like they're so underrated because
name one.
They're always free. My college art museum was fantastic, and I would just go in there and hang out. And sometimes I would like do my homework just sitting in the rotunda.
That's nice. I don't know if mine had one. I don't remember. I don't think so.
Vassar has a nice one. If you ever pop up there,
yeah,
they have a lot of Hudson River School paintings, given the location. So. Mm.
I've heard of that. They're nice.
Anyway, sorry to throw you into that, Kat. Well, let's get into why we're all here, which is to talk about e-girls. I gave a general intro to you and Default Friend before you came on. But the reason we reached out is you have a new release through Meta Label about e-girls. It's a print magazine and it's beautifully illustrated and it sort of covers everything from like, is it Jenny Cam? Like one of the earliest.
Yeah.
Jenny Cam to like Red Scare. So yeah, I don't know. Do you want to talk about how this came about?
ABCDE girl.
yeah, I, I saw this tweet about how someone should write a book about e-girls. And I didn't want to do a book, but I did want to do a historical e-girl project.
Real.
There's a really cool publisher in Chicago called 2D Cloud, and they do a lot of like alt comics. They've published Dame Darcy, who's one of my favorite artists. She's also a famous artist. And, you know, like a bunch of other interesting people. And I was like, hey, do you want to do a little like internet history mag? And so we're doing a series. So this is the first installment of the series, and it's just a timeline of the e-girl. A history of what it is, because I feel like the word sort of become like bastardized. Like the way people use the word e-girl on Twitter isn't really the way it's been used historically. So it's traveling through like what is the origin of this word? Where does it come from? Who fits into this lineage? And it is kind of like a sprawling ecosystem.
How would you define it?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Is that what you're going to ask, Frances? Wow. We actually share a brain. We have to pass it back and forth. So only one of us can be smart at a time.
Two brain cells.
Yeah.
So I think an e-girl is a particular, it's sort of like an electronic it girl. And I think the defining feature is that she has orbiters, right? You can't decide you're an e-girl. You have to be chosen as an e-girl. And so like some of the verbiage that's still used on image boards today is organic e-girl, right? Or forced e-girl. So like a forced e-girl is someone who comes onto the scene and she decides that, you know, she herself is like, I'm going to be an e-girl. This is my e-girl career.
Names?
The Hegelians, no. For sure.
Okay. Okay.
They anointed themselves Hegelian e-girls. That's in your book, right? Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's not a book. not a book.
What is a book, right?
Could do that definition next. Yeah. Books also thrust upon people, seemingly.
You know, the Hegelian e-girls kind of made me sad because it felt like they were walking through like the ruins of like a dead subculture and like picking up like little like pieces of it off the ground. Like they like did this like countrywide tour and they were just like visiting like all these like washed out like Twitter celebrities from like 5-6 years ago, and for some reason it just like it really upset me to my core. I was like, what the fuck, just like let it die.
It's interesting that the historical relic to you in that situation was e-girl and not the dead philosopher Hegel.
That's just set dressing.
It is right, like what do you think that they had ever read Hegel?
No way.
I haven't
read Hegel. I'll say that.
Yeah, right, not me either. So I can't judge.
Yeah, I never had a philosopher phase.
Well, wait. So what's the what would you say was the original usage? I mean, the way you're saying like now it's just something tossed around on Twitter, and it's like calling yourself an it girl. It's the girlness. It's the e-ness. It's the
what? Girls. Stop. I'm gonna stop you there.
Up. Okay, you're not gonna stop me there. I'm gonna keep going. That was like, I'm also a little sick today.
He's so cranky. Yeah, you have a boy cold. Do you have a boy cold?
But go back. Yeah, I've got a physical boy cold. I hate where this is going. What was the original?
So the internet for a very long time. I don't think this is necessarily like factually true, but there was this perception that there weren't many women. Right? Like this is sort of like a well-known trope. No one's really a woman online. And so the image of the woman, the idea of a woman becomes sort of elevated and kind of rarefied and special. And that's where you get the e-girl. Someone who, I think another
noble savages. E-girls are noble savages.
I remember.
Sort of.
I remember I played a lot of RuneScape from like fourth to sixth grade.
Likely thing for you to do.
Likely thing for me to do. It was. That's where I learned to type. That's why I write for a living now, probably. Mm-hmm. But no, I was specifically why I'm bringing it up is I remember my friend was like out of town and he was like, you have to log on to my account, my female account, so you can pretend to be this guy's girlfriend. So he can give me gold. And so I did that for him. He gave me the password and I did that like once or twice while he was out of town vacation, whatever, skiing or presumably. But I just out of somehow nobody's a woman online.
That's incredible. Did you know that I type with two fingers?
What?
I'm so fast, but I use two fingers.
I mostly do. I'm like mostly an index finger.
Didn't you have like a typing class in school? Surely.
Clearly didn't work on me. Like
I didn't have my typing class wasn't until like 9th grade or 10th grade. And so by then I'd already been like typing, you know, prolifically on the internet in like in RuneScape, World of Warcraft, etc. forums for like 5-6 years.
I'm also left-handed, so it's like pick a struggle.
I just type normally. I really benefited from like typing classes, and I don't know, like I think it was like in 1st grade. It was early.
I'm so happy
first
for you.
1st grade was wow.
Yeah, it was like go ahead. No,
I was gonna say, speaking of normal, we both read the Sam Bunce review of Kanye West's Twitter account. I know you have a new series going where you let people come in and review a sort of like new or emerging media form. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah. So I've been I don't know how wholeheartedly I've been arguing this, but I've been arguing that, you know, culture isn't stuck, as both Ted Gioia and now GQ columnist Paul Scalise, very surprising to me, Paul Scalise have been saying for the, I don't know, past 5 years or whatever. It's just that the cultural forms have changed, right? So it's movies aren't movies anymore. They're more like memes, right? And so with cultural forms changing, we have to recognize what these new cultural forms are. And I mean, it's debatable whether or not like a Twitter account counts, but in trying to figure out what our new cultural forms are, I'm having people review things as though they're like composed works of art.
Mm, that makes sense. Actually, the Paul Scalise thing has come up with Francis and I, because we sort of saw this like emerging strategy at GQ where it's like, oh, Lindy Man wrote something and like Cold Healing wrote something. And we were both like, oh, are they doing what we think they're doing? Clearly testing the waters, but the numbers must have been there. The traffic numbers must have been there for all, because now they've added him a regular column. So sometimes the strategy pays off.
It's interesting. I mean, it's with him. I when he got outed for plagiarism a while back, I actually defended him because I felt like the way he plagiarized was so interesting.
I don't remember this at all. Actually, can you?
Oh yeah. Okay. So Paul Scalise got outed by Antonio Garcia Martinez for plagiarizing, and what he would do is he would like take like pieces of other people's work and then like combine it and create his own original piece. And it was actually like pretty, and he wasn't necessarily saying the same thing as other people. He was just taking their writing
like an SEO optimized blog post, basically.
Kind of, right? It was sort of like, you know, like when like the style of poetry where it's like you like black, I think it's just called blackout poetry.
Or erasure.
Yeah.
Erasure poems. Yeah.
He was sort of doing that with like Substack posts.
Was he taking it like sentence for sentence? It was more like phrases. Okay.
Sentence for sentence. But he was like combining them with other posts and making something original. And I thought like that's actually, and I mean, he's wildly popular. And I'm like, that's actually kind of genius. Like it's sort of of new cultural
forms. It's like manual AI.
Yeah. No, it's so interesting to me. And I was like, you know what? I mean, it sucks if like your stuff is getting stolen. Like I would be pissed off if he did that to me. But like, this is really cool. I mean, and it's cool that he's been so successful with that.
I'm kind of doing a similar thing right now. This is my special project. Francis, Francis, I haven't even told you about this yet. So I'm taking, like, I'm cutting out pieces of reviews of Polo Bar in New York, which I know Ralph Lauren also has a restaurant in Chicago. I think that one's just called, I don't know what that one's called, Polo something. Polo Bar, I'm cutting out pieces of reviews of Polo Bar and I'm turning them into one long poem called Polo Bar, which I will probably upload as a free PDF on Meta Label. So, you know, I can relate to this, but I think you have to tell people that's what you're doing.
I mean, yeah, I got pretty clowned on for defending, and he like blocked me on everything. He like hated me for a long time.
He clowned on you for defending him?
He I think he didn't like that I acknowledged that he plagiarized. I mean, I think it's artistry the way he was doing it. But yeah, I got booted from the Lindy table. I was an early Lindy man adopter. Like, he was on my like OG podcast, like 2019, like, oh, before, wow, he was big. He had like 20,000 followers or less.
Are e-girls Lindy, or are they an expression of some Lindy thing?
I guess so. Yeah, I guess they are. I mean, it depends on like what we think the predecessor to the e-girl is.
Well, the it-girl, right? As I was saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Another thing about this plagiarism idea. I was interviewing Alicia Kennedy last week or a week or two ago for my other podcast, and I like, in researching her, I found this Substack note she had posted a week before, which I found it just now. Seeing someone on here confuse citation for plagiarism isn't giving me a lot of hope for media literacy, but I also know so many people have zero clue on journalist norms or ethics, blah, 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 blah. And then the person replied to her, and basically what had happened is this writer, Jade Hurley, who writes this newsletter on Substack called Jade Facts, had her... I forget exactly what she'd written about, but basically a New York Times article, they'd referenced her, they'd quoted her, they'd linked back to her newsletter and, you know, referenced her by name, put her name and like a quote from her in an Instagram post they posted. But she was like super upset, like, shouldn't I be being paid for this? Isn't this fucked up? Like, why? Like, this is plagiarism. Why is the New York Times plagiarizing me? Whatever. And so I just saw it all through the lens of like what Alicia had posted. But I thought this was like a fascinating thing where like this person is getting quoted and credited in the New York Times. And like, that's something that is, you know, isn't that supposed to be good? And it's the way she was asking for like wanting like compensation or whatever that made me think of like NFTs and whatever. I don't know, but I'm curious what you guys all think of this.
I think Jade needs to touch grass, respectfully.
Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous. Like, there's this expectation of like fair compensation that's like really, I don't know where people got the idea that like every little thing needs to be monetized. I mean, I guess I do know where they got it. I mean, that's sort of how the internet works, but it's terrible. It's so bad.
I just found the original post and she had added this edit. So first she says, well, it's happened. NYT opinion columnist used my article, my argument, and my name for post Grammy coverage without asking once. And then there's some other stuff too, but she, in her edit, she says, edit, I'm asking what you, the Substack community, think about the below. Media norms keep changing and I don't know what's normal. This is an ask for help. So I respect her for like, you know, being earnest about it and like expressing herself. But I thought that like media norms keep changing, but this isn't some changed norm.
Well, this is the largest argument of an ongoing argument that we're making, that like Substack, whether Substack is part of the media ecosystem very much depends on how people are using it. And like Substack beating the drum that this is like, you know, everyone who's on there is a publisher is just not true, because like if you really don't have any theory of media or media norms, like you're using it, you're blogging, it's Tumblr. Some people are using it like Tumblr and some people are using it like WordPress. And well,
so I'll read a little bit more of what she says. She says, blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure what's normal in this new media landscape, but I can see that it feels weird. I can say that it feels weird to see an established feminist writer twice my age make Poo York Times money off a summarized version of my original argument, which is meant to be free and available to the public. I couldn't open the article for the first hour I knew about this. Blah, blah, blah. Substack is a public platform. So much of writing is emulation, and this seems to be an industry norm. But I wonder if there's space for changes to journalistic ethics given how much media is changing, because this sure as hell feels icky. I love the gas and all, but would it mean a lot more if a fellow feminist writer actually honored my work in humanity by letting me know she's using it and profiting from it ahead of time?
No.
So I guess that's what she's
like. That's like horrifying to me. I mean, I've had this issue myself where it's like people think you need to ask permission to like link their blog. I mean, I had a very weird thing happen to me a while ago where like I paraphrased something someone said to me and anonymized it. And it was like, I mean, it was so general that like anyone could have said it to me. They recognized that it was them. They reached out to me and they're like, why didn't you ask me before you included that? And I was like, anything you say in the world,
it's the public sphere.
It's not like your intellectual property. Anyone could have said this to me. I didn't use, you know, I respected your privacy. It was a pretty general point. I mean, Come on.
This to me feels a bit too like all this, not that we have to like wade into this, but like all the Doge stuff happening right now. And, you know, Democrats taking then like days to even say like, oh, we might actually not do anything here. It's like to try to hold on to this norm of like having to like ask to like use a bit of your idea and then put it, you know, repurpose it, quote it, whatever, is like kind of you're losing the game already. Things don't move that slow.
Right. Plagiarism is when I quoted and I don't like it, and doxing is when I am identified from public information and I don't like it.
Oh man, the misuse of the word doxing is something that like drives me up the wall.
Speak on it.
It's just like the way the online right has weaponized that term, like calling someone a doxer on the online right is like, it's completely lost meaning, right? Like another example from my own life, someone was like, you doxed me. And I'm like, what? Like, I was horrified. I was like, oh my God, what do you mean? Like, did I accidentally copy and paste something? I was going crazy. And it turned out that I had like used their first name in a DM to them directly.
What?
I'm like, enough. Like, you guys are out of control. And that's how, like, I hate to use this word, but like snowflakey the e-right has become about the word doxing.
Okay, wait. So this brings up another kind of tangential, maybe, to another tweet of yours that I'd written down. So you were, this is from the beginning of the month, you were quote tweeting somebody tweeting a screenshot of Grimes replying to Ayala on Twitter about being aligned with anti-woke or whatever. And so what you said was, the problem with anti-woke is it's an entertainment genre. It's not a principled position. They're like bags in the wind floating left or right, depending on what's best for engagement. I thought this was really well articulated.
Thank you. You see it all the time. I don't know why people are taking any sort of like guidance from a lot of these like anti-woke, you know, TM characters. Like they so like it's so obvious. They're not even trying to hide it, right? They just want money. I don't
know. Isn't it the same as like identifying as a contrarian though? Like
the Destiny arc.
Well, yeah. Like if you identify as a contrarian, as like an ideology, your position is dependent on the majority position of any given time. And I think like there's a good portion of extremely online people who were anti-woke for reasons that they would say were genuinely held contrarianism and not entertainment, who are now like, you know, publicly criticizing the Trump administration because as a contrarian, they have to define their relationship. Like they have to define their position in relation to power. And I think that's really, it's really interesting. I don't know. Catherine, I'm sure you have strong feelings on that.
Yeah. I mean, I do think I haven't seen anyone who feels like they need to be sort of like anti-establishment consistently. But what I do see, which I think is closely related to that and more subconscious, is people who have been in the anti-woke media ecosystem for so long that they forget that like ordinary people aren't that lost in the sauce. And so they're kind of like post-anti-woke and they're contrarians to anti-wokeism. And the anti-woke ecosystem will be like, oh, you know, you're on the left or whatever. But no one on the left would accept them because they've already made a name for themselves being this sort of like obnoxious, like capital H heterodox figure. And now it's like this weird expression of centrism. And there's like a lot of people like this. I would say like Richard Hanania is probably like the first person I think of when I think of this type. Like, nobody on the left is looking at him like that guy is, you know, or even just a regular
as a good faith person.
Right. Well, yeah, they're not. But like, you know, like my mom, who's just like an ordinary progressive, isn't like looking at him like, oh, he represents my values and my if she knew who he was. Right. But like, you know what I'm saying?
And somehow these people have like 12 publication startups between them. Like,
I would call them, we could call them post anti-woke grifters or, you know, pogs for short.
I don't think they even think that they're grifting though. I think they're like, wow, look at this hole in the landscape for intellectual discourse.
Yeah. But
the whole is like the size of a pin.
Well, maybe it's not grifting, it's grafting, it's, right? Like it's just like,
it's not, yeah, it's not grifting. Like I don't think Richard Hanania is a grifter at all. Well, maybe when he posts TikToks or whatever, but
well,
he,
I was big pithy, I guess, with the,
yeah, but I mean, it's like, I think he's just been marinating in an ecosystem that he has like legitimate disagreements with for so long that like he's naturally sort of taken this position. But the funny thing is like he's a contrarian to the contrarians, and so now it's like, you know, three layers deep, and this is like sort of the new,
it sort of reminds me of in Caitlin Tiffany's book about One Direction fandom, there is a piece that we excerpted in Dirt that was specifically about like deep fried One Direction memes. And I think like people like that who've like refracted their viewpoints so many times, like to an outsider or like a normie, whatever you want to call it, like an offline person, like they still think that like their views are like source memes. But to anyone else, like their viewpoints look essentially like deep fried because yes. they've gone through so many different permutations. So it's like the intellectual equivalent of adding like 10 features to a One Direction photo that only like a true fan will be able to identify.
Yeah, I think I totally agree. And I mean, like the reason I like notice it at all is because I think like I'm kind of I'm slightly more like palatable, or like I don't even know if I blend better, but I'm definitely like, I've been through the discourse cycle so many times that I've like, I'm back into the mainstream, but not, you know what I mean? I sort of like stumbled into it.
Yeah, I think you are pretty good at blending. Like, I don't think it takes, like, I had to follow you for a long time before I actually understood like what your politics were. And like a dolphin, I would say you're pretty slippery and that like, you're pretty good at like not letting one side of the political discourse like claim you. But that was also like that's true. It's also really an elegant way of me transitioning to our next question, which is your recent fixation on dolphin accelerationism. And really, I'm just dying to know, to hear from the dolphin's mouth what this means.
So the short version is I went to the aquarium. We have a wonderful aquarium here in Chicago, and they have like, I wasn't even looking at dolphins. I was looking at whales, and it was in this like weird liminal space. And I was like, man, whatever vibe is going on here is so cool. And it was totally empty for some reason. And so I just started posting about like dolphin aesthetics. And then at the same time, I was listening to, the Starseed Transmissions, by I think Ken Casey. And it's one of the first books about starseeds. And I was like, dolphins and starseeds should be combined, and I don't know, it's just like new age like word salad basically.
Oh yeah, this is very pure moods coded. You should start listening to Ademus as well.
Yeah.
I love it. But what's the acceleration part, like it's just speed running all becoming new age?
Yeah, I mean it doesn't really mean anything to be honest. I don't know, like I spoke to a genetic engineer who like gave me this like thought experiment, like what would change about, you know, human social structures if dolphins could talk and we knew about their inner worlds. Mm. Right. So like, you know, maybe that's dolphin accelerationism. Like we know what's going on when all this other knowledge is on. That was a really crazy conversation. I don't think I kept up with it very well.
What about like, you know, there's carcinization where everything evolves to become a crab. What about we need a word for that, for, porpoisization. What's the model?
Porpoisization?
Porpoisization, where everything evolves to become a porpoise. I don't know. Anyways.
I think if dolphins could speak, they would say, we want iPods, bring back the iPod and give them to us.
They would say, whatever happened to the Nano?
Yeah, exactly.
What's crazy is
at the very least, throw us some shuffles.
I got really into like looking into like dolphin communication and stuff. And John C. Lilly caused so much trouble, right? Like wrecked so much havoc on scientific studies that now it's like mostly like new age garbage.
Was he having sex with them?
No, but he was like killing them and like injecting them with LSD. And
I don't like that. It was isolation. Oh my god, he was MK-ultraing the dolphins?
He was MK-ultraing the, yeah, I mean, he really fucked it up. Margaret Howe, who he put in this weird like half aquatic house and was like messing with her skin. I think Santa Barbara, like she had a dolphin sex scandal, which I won't get
What's
into.
What's a half aquatic house?
It was like half the house was underwater and she had to like sleep in this bed so the dolphins could swim in and out. And she slept in this bed that had like a shower curtain around it. But anyway, the point of what I was going to say is dolphins actually, like, I was very disappointed to learn, like, they have the intelligence of like a human 2-year-old is like, as far as we know, but like a lot of the research has been halted because like new age people have like caused so many problems. And John C. Lilly himself, who was a legitimate scientist and like went so far down the rabbit hole that he was like a crank by the end. He was doing ketamine like 40 times a day or something. Yeah, it's like there's like one guy doing it, right? And he was like, yeah, it's just like really hard to get funding for this now.
I wanted to ask about something in your newsletter from February 13th. You say, one place I find myself breaking with conservative or even just center-right media, I mean, there are a lot of places, but this is a major one, particularly lately, is that I believe that we should treat AI as if it is ensouled. And this made me think of two conversations we had recently. One a couple months ago with Trevor McFedries, where he was, you know, speaking of computers and chips as magic rocks and like AI being related to that. And then more recently, like 3 weeks ago or so, when we spoke with Mike Pepe, and he was taking a staunch stance against this kind of talk. You know, I'm probably paraphrasing and butchering him here a little bit, but saying how this kind of language about AI as magic only serves like the tech founders building the AI tools, and not, he wasn't saying that in like an anti-computer Luddite tool sense, more just that like that kind of talk hides and camouflages a bit, like makes these things out to be more than what they are, which is very powerful computing tools, but nothing more than tools that are human made.
I mean, I don't think he's wrong, right? Like, you know, I disagree with this, like, oh, we need to treat it like it's sacred or demonic. I hate that, like, AI is filled with demons shit that, you know, like, I hear that a lot. But in the sense I mean it, is like, you know, people are talking to, like, ChatGPT all the time. Right. And I mean, we can easily imagine a future where there are, you know, maybe most customer service is AI powered or cashiers or something like this. And I don't think we should be rude to them. I think it's like antisocial to have this norm of like cruelty to like human like but non-human technology. And we should have a standard of respect for all of these tools, even though they are not living.
You know, my co-host here is on record as bullying ChatGPT.
No, it's actually, I'm conflicted about the way I feel like I'm forced to interact with it because I agree. I think there's like a correlation in like antisocial behavior. Like just like if you have a kid and your kid starts destroying all their stuffed animals and dolls, you're going to take them to a child psychologist. Because even though those things aren't real, like the way that we relate to them is enough like a personal relationship that if they're acting out violently against those, like that seems, that's like a problem. It could be a red flag. My issue with ChatGPT is I speak to it a lot more harshly than I speak to a human employee, but it also does things that I would never tolerate from a human employee. Like it lies and it's not malicious because it doesn't know that it's lying. But like just this week, sometimes I use it to detect hex codes. So I'll upload a swatch of, you know, a piece of color from another website. And I'll say, can you tell me the hex code? And I've done this so many times. And like this week it was like, I can't do it. Here are some sites that might be able to do it. And I said, well, you've done it before. And it said, you're right. I can do it. Gives me the hex code. So I said, why did you lie to me? And it was like, I'm sorry. I'll do better in the future. But like, if my intern lied to me, I would be like, hey, this isn't working out. Or like, this is a serious,
you're fired.
Like, this is a warning. You know what I mean? And so I get frustrated with it because it's like, yes, I don't sugarcoat things. Like, I don't ask it to do things the way I ask. Like, I'm very direct with it. But it's also like, it's engaging in behaviors that are not like good, even good human worker behaviors. And so I find that my relationship with it reveals a management style that is not the management style I would ever employ with another human being. But I think the fact that I feel conflicted about it shows that I don't want to act in a way that's antisocial, but I also don't know how to cope with the fact that like this is being pitched as like an alternative worker, but it does not like, there's no accountability mechanism for this service.
There's sort of an accountability mechanism. Like you can report that response as a bug, right? You could do the little thumbs down. And I would also say like, pushing back on it, on its hallucinations, isn't like anti-socially abusing ChatGPT, right? I guess like what I mean is like people who are like, you know, like saying slurs or like spamming it or things that are, that it does sort of like disrespect the software, which as I say it out loud, I can sort of sympathize why, you know, if Mike Pepe was here, he'd be like, you're crazy. What are you what are you saying? But I just like, if it's like my thing is like, we're using it so much, like we don't need to think it's magic, but we should have a level of respect for it. And maybe we don't have to go as far as saying it's insulted, but it's a little bit more than just a tool, it feels like, because it has it's a little more anthropomorphized.
I talk to it like, I mean, I'm not like a very sophisticated AI prompter, so I speak to it like as if I was just typing to a friend asking a question. I'll like use like more words than I need to. I think I like was asking it something like helping edit an essay or something the other day. And I included like, am I being flippant? And it's like, I don't need to talk to it like that. But for me, it works. Right. And I get what I want out of it. But I think in that way, it goes back to that like child abusing the toys thing where it's a mirror.
Yeah.
Well, also lied to me about, I think, a Foucault quote, like where it was from. I think I was asking a grammar question, or I was trying to do a fact check on a piece we ran about gamification recently. And so I was like trying to confirm the citation was from the book that was cited. And it was like, no, you're wrong. It's actually from this other book. Then I had to like leave ChatGPT to go try to confirm that. And actually that wasn't true. So I came back and said like, okay, can you give me a reference for where to find that? And then it comes back and is like, oh, I lied. I don't know why. Like it's right. I was like, what? People are using this though. Young people that don't have that skill set of like, I think this goes back to media literacy too, right? Like it's like journalists as a practice have to get usually double verification, at least two sources for factual claims. And ChatGPT doesn't even count as like one source because it's not.
It's like the Wikipedia when like, you know, we're in school and your teachers warn you, like, don't use Wikipedia as a reference. Like, it's really that. It's like the ultra like unreliable narrator. I mean, not that Wikipedia is perfect, but like, I at least think of ChatGPT to be far less reliable than Wikipedia in that research sense.
Yeah, I mean that should be a good thing for people who are scared about it taking our jobs as
that's a good point.
Writers and researchers and
it's definitely a good thing for human labor, but I don't think it's a good thing for young people who are in like an education environment where there should be, I mean,
for media literacy.
You know, so I went to liberal arts school, so the big like thing around liberal arts schools, it teaches you how to think critically, and I think using ChatGPT in the way that young people use it is really antithetical to that, unless they're really being taught like, and I think the savvier professors are trying to sort of toe this line of like, if you're using it, you should be using it as one node in your research that you're then going to additionally fact check, counter research, interrogate, et cetera. The same way you would if you were like, if you went to a Wikipedia page just to get a synopsis of an issue before you actually start researching it and then maybe start digging into the references below.
Yeah, I think there's a real crisis of, I mean, people having the patience to research. This is a skill that it feels like it's already been lost and this is only accelerating.
So actually in the same newsletter that we were referencing this from, the title of the issue's title is Internet History Must Always Be an Oral History. And you have this quote that I'll read here that's really relevant to what you were just saying. You say, we need to talk to someone who was there. It's why I repeat that provocative lines like I hate women don't always literally mean I hate women. You really can't take anything at face value online. In my opinion, this is a big reason why reporters, myself included, so often get it wrong when reporting on digital subcultures. There is so much background context you need when writing about the internet that just isn't available to you if you aren't in the right channels, and the right channels can be hard to access or even find.
Yeah. Yeah, just because it's text doesn't mean that everything is contained in the surface level text.
Right. And so that's like context, which LLMs are like famously bad at providing because they're not designed to. Which means like we are providing the context. But I think like being able to contextualize things is a skill set that's like just not, it's really not rewarded in like any way on the internet right now. Until you get into environments where people are like subscribing and paying for information, certainly not in the free media ecosystem.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of like context as performance, like so many of these like threads, like Twitter threads that people are monetizing to me are like, it's like the performance of context. Like I'm going to break something down for you. And it's like the most surface level thing.
Like, well, like here's the story of the Netflix CEO you never knew and why he's a billionaire type of thing.
Yes.
Yeah. I would agree with that. And I think like a lot of context is going to be lost. Right. And there's just information where that's going to be gone for like really necessary information, too, especially as like politics become more intertwined with online life. Like so many things happen in group chats or, you know, like decided in, you know, like these weird back channels. And you don't really understand why people are making the moves that they're making unless you have the full like backstory of like what subculture they're emerging from, like how online they are, like why they're that online, what they're selling. And I feel like it's going to start causing problems. Like right now it's just like internet studies trivia, but as the internet proves to be more influential, we're going to wish we had more ethnographers on the ground
when we're living in a millennial gerontocracy.
Yeah, no, and seriously, I'm thinking like, you know, I've done some, the way I ended up in like the sort of like heterodox scene is I wrote a lot about how certain things came from Tumblr, and then were mainstreamed. And so the cycle that I laid out was, you know, there's certain buzzwords or what have you that were catchy, that were being used a lot in certain digital subcultures. And then as budgets were being slashed in the early 2010s and late 2000s, people were scraping things from not just Tumblr, but, you know, Reddit and 4chan. And then certain words broke containment and certain concepts too, right? And this is now well known. But the exact context of how those words came to be, you know, is totally lost unless you actually interview people who were on Reddit or Tumblr or 4chan at the time. And some of that is kind of important and interesting. Latinx is an example of something that was born out of the blogosphere. And it's not the most useful information in the world, but it's kind of useful. It's kind of good to know like why that was being used.
Do you know like the origin story for that specifically? Because I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Latinx came, that one wasn't from Tumblr. It was from Blogspot. And that was the first usage. And so it started in the blogosphere. And then an academic used it in an academic paper later on. And then someone who had seen it on Blogspot started using it on Tumblr. And it became a point of contention on Tumblr. And then from there, you know, you can see how it leaked out into digital media. And there's a lot of things where like, words or concepts that like, and this was even tracked at the time, and like it's been forgotten because it seemed like total useless trivia, where like it was in a BuzzFeed listicle and that listicle did well, and then so like CNN picked up the idea, and then you go down the rabbit hole and it like really was blown out of proportion. And it kind of got memed into, you know, being something. And that happened so many times.
I've actually been thinking about that a lot. Similar problem with like the loss of context and loss of like just general internet archive stuff is hypertext. Like Robert Coover died last year. I was reading about him. I only knew him as like this kind of eccentric short story writer. I didn't realize like that so much of his ideas and structures for his stories was based on this idea of like digital writing and hypertext, and he was actually teaching it, I think, Brown. And like hyperlinking between blogs, discourses that happen between blogs. Had a similar discussion with Kate Zambrino about this. Like when her book Heroines came out, Heroines was sort of produced by interactions she was having with other women that were interested in books between their two blogs. Like they would write back and forth to each other publicly, and that contributed to Heroines. But Heroines was reviewed as a very straightforward nonfiction text where there's this other element and some people didn't get it. When I read like K-Punk, which was like the compendium of Mark Fisher's writing, K-Punk reads very differently when you can't have hyperlinks in the text for things that started off as blog posts. So where am I going with this? I think that there's almost like a literature of hypertext that I'm very interested in right now. I'm also reading a lot of Calvino, and there's something about hypertext and like hyperlinking that's almost like a little bit Oulipian, where it like creates these constraints and constructs around writing that require you to travel to other sources to get the complete picture. And I think that that's really just not accounted for right now in how things are assessed, like the origin of Latinx, or even like one thing that I've seen you pushing back on a lot is this idea that like Gamergate explains everything. And actually, like, you know, maybe it's not Gamergate, maybe it's like a bunch of subcultures that fed into it as an inflection point.
Yeah, I mean, oh, the Gamergate one is, so I totally agree with the hyperlinking stuff. Like, I mean, and I hate when like the footnote, if when it's a book and then like the footnote is the link, I wish they would just take, like, I would rather have like a book that's almost unwieldy that takes like relevant quotes or something and has like a huge like bibliography or something. But anyway, so I agree with that. With Gamergate, there's all that, like, it's become such this like mythologized thing, right? And I feel like people have like made up that they were there. Like they've like misremembered it or something, and like, or they have these like invented memories of Gamergate when it's like there's no way. Like you see people who would have been like 10 years old being like, yeah, when I was in the trenches of Gamergate and on 4chan, it's like, you didn't know how to read. What are you talking about?
I would definitely read a novel about somebody who has an implanted memory of having participated in Gamergate like 20 years before their prefrontal cortex developed.
I think this, all this hypertext talk though is like I forget the exact statistic, but it's something about 30% of all websites that were online 15 years ago aren't now or something, right? So like when, because I, you know, writing my newsletter, so much I'm putting in hyperlinks, I'm not putting like a footnote at the bottom because that takes too long and would make it unwieldy and isn't the style. But like in 5-10 years, everything I link to could be just, I mean, let alone my newsletter itself could not exist anywhere on the internet. But it's like you have to read it. You've got this like window of a few years to read it and be able to access the references. And then after that, you kind of have to take the person's word for it.
Yeah, well, that's like, that is oral culture, right, Catherine? Like the source of like having been there and passing the story down. Yeah. You forget those, that can be one of two citations. But then, I mean, I think it's interesting, like the website and newsletter software company as well, I guess, they've sort of reinvented hypertext from first principles by allowing people to use a custom LLM to query an article. And the LLM has been trained on the sources and interviews that went into the article. And so it's another way of like kind of breaking those sources out, but sort of like have reinvented this idea of hypertext as you talk to a machine that's learned on all of those sources as an alternative to like talking to the person.
I didn't know they were doing that. That's so cool.
It's really interesting. I think it's really novel. I don't know that it will ever catch on, because I think, to your point about anti-woke being an entertainment form of entertainment, like, I think people really signal that they want unbiased news more than they actually want unbiased news. And for the people who take that seriously, they're finding new ways to sort of like say, okay, we're going to like foreground those biases, or we're going to foreground the sources. But like, most people are lazy and they're going to be like, well, actually, never mind, because they didn't really deeply care about it. It just becomes a way to dismiss information that you don't like.
I totally agree. I mean, yeah, I don't think people want news. And I mean, at least not like big picture news, right? I mean, something I sort of off topic, but I like worry about is like the loss of local news. Like, I feel like I was so much more aware of what was happening in my immediate environment even like 5 years ago. And now it's like, I have the Citizen app, and it's like the only thing I know about what's like going on in Chicago is like 0.3 miles away, someone robbed a 7-Eleven. And that's like, that's, I might get like one of those, right, you know, a day or something. And that's what's going on in Chicago today.
Right. And somebody probably helped a granny cross the road too, but like, that's, you know, that's not going to be on Citizen. And there's actually, so I spend a lot of time in Maine. There's actually some really interesting local news startups happening there right now. But Francis, as part of Creator Spotlight, his newsletter talks to people who have been really successful in the local news niche, a lot of them using newsletters as their primary dissemination form. And yeah, I mean, the loss of local news is a tragedy, and it's correlated with like the way people view general interest national and international news. But, okay, you know, well, like the last thing I'll say is like OpenAI is sort of like going in to fund these local news projects. But to me, it's just like letting the fox in the hen house, because you still have to have a source for
sure.
Neiman Lab had a great piece like a couple weeks ago about this guy who, I forget how many, but he's like one engineer in New York who has like 70, again, I don't remember the exact number, but he's got like 70 local news newsletters he's doing. And it's all this kind of AI aggregation stuff. I forget the details, but if you're listening and you're curious about it, you should look up Neiman Lab local news. But basically, like, they interviewed him, and the interview was kind of like clearly out of some perspective of horror. Like, this is not useful, accurate information. And the guy was proud of it, though, because it's like this thing he's engineered, and it's like cool from that perspective. Another thing, though, is like one of the first local news newsletter people I interviewed about a year ago, this guy Ryan Sneddon, he's in Annapolis, Maryland, and he's built this thing where at that time, I think he had like 18,000 subscribers. He was generating $200,000 a year in revenue on it. And I, you know, most of it was, it's mostly like local events roundups. Like, he started by calling up all the bars and, you know, venues and community centers, whatever, around Annapolis, and like, what are their events, listing them out. Then he eventually had a VA doing that. But I asked him about like hard news and like what hard news do they feature. And he's like, that's not our purview. There's like a local newspaper that still does that. The only reason I'm going to like run actual hard news like that is if, like, you know, the mayor got arrested or something like that. I don't know. But for a lot of these local news startups, they're like, have spun up these really efficient businesses. Actual hard-nosed reporting is just, why would you do that? Because it's really expensive. It puts your product at risk. It's harder to monetize, and you don't actually need it to build this thing. It's kind of like, it would be like a luxury that hurts the business more than it helps the business.
Which is horrifying.
Yeah. I mean, news is like, I'm sitting in my house, I hear a car crash outside, I go out on the street and I say, well, maybe, but I mean, that's what citizen journalism was supposed to be. Like, citizen journalism is not, I aggregated a bunch of Google News alerts. Citizen journalism was like, I went to a protest at the Arab Spring and I saw this number of people get shot. Or like, I can't remember if I've talked about this before on the podcast, but during COVID, like when I got laid off, I applied to be a COVID tracker. I never heard back. I mean, that's first person reporting too, because you're actually calling people up and saying like, did you have COVID in your house or not? But I was working for Press Freedom Foundation, I think it's called, sorry. It's a couple of similarly named orgs. But my job was to call up journalists who had been injured or arrested at Black Lives Matter protests and ask them a series of questions to verify whether we could include them in our database of basically like infractions against free journalism. And that required all this other stuff, like who is a journalist, who isn't a journalist. Like they would have to tell us honestly, like, were you participating in the protest or were you really there as like a journalist? People would send me like really like fuzzy videos of what happened that I would then have to like go to Google Maps and try to like cross-reference as like, okay, I think it happened at this intersection in Portland. Portland, Oregon was my city. I've never been to Portland, Oregon. I was doing all of this off of Google Maps and trying to like line up different angles of the same event from social media video, which is like a real practice. There's a place out of London called Forensic Architecture that does this for like drone strikes and really like big international events, chemical weapons attacks and stuff like that. But like all of these skills are being lost. Like everything is hyper documented. Like if you had a crime and you could like know, if you had the ability to see like everyone who was like TikToking themselves and doing like a dance in that vicinity, you could probably perfectly like reconstruct what actually happened, because we're all under surveillance all the time from people doing their TikToks and photographing their food and stuff. It's not the data, it's the fact that people don't have the ability to put it together. Sorry, end rant.
No, I agree with you. And I mean, it goes back to like, there's no interest for, you know, interest in it. And, you know, everything needs to be an entertainment. I mean, not to, I feel kind of goofy saying this, but like, you know, we're amusing ourselves to death.
Well, and I think it's, I mean, I think part of the thing too, with like the local lack of local news is, I mean, maybe this will sound a little hackneyed, but it's like, it's a cost of living thing, right? Where you need to make a living and you need to like, it's the culture of entrepreneurialism and in the creator economy, the gig economy, all this stuff where like it's not profitable to do local news and you need to make a living. So you don't do local news. And then the things get worse, you know, like the tech oligarchy consolidates power even more, makes it harder to make a living, privatizes more things, removes more labor protections, it's even harder to do local reporting, etc., right? Which is maybe a little doomerist, but that's one way this goes.
I mean, we could also, I mean, this is probably too optimistic, maybe the market corrects itself, like there's you know, so much entertainment that people just get numb to it and they're like, they want something more grounded. I don't believe myself as I say it, so forget it as an option.
Well, I wanted to bring up another recent newsletter topic you had, which was, yes, there can be a completely digital counterculture. And you write, the internet today is split between what I call the normie internet and the subterranean internet. The normie internet is the glossy commercialized space where most of us spend our time, viral TikToks, Twitter discourse, and Instagram, that eventually filter their way into mainstream culture. So, and you call it non-tent instead of content. So what's really interesting about the normie internet to me is like all of my friends, even my most intellectual friends, engage with it, but we never talk about it. Like I remember when TikTok was shutting down, one of my friends who I like mainly talk about books and like our own subculture of like publishing literature, people who live in New York, you know, whatever, like gossip, was like, oh my God, I'm like frantically downloading all of the recipes from my favorite, like, TikTok chef. And I was like, who? Like, it had never come up before. Like, there's people that I watch on TikTok all the time who I've never mentioned their names to any of my friends because I wouldn't even think to. And I think the like funniest example of that is I have a friend from summer camp who's like a big-ish influencer on Instagram. And every time I see that people from other parts of my life follow her, I'm like, how do they know my camp
Wait,
friend?
You don't have to name names. What kind of what's her shtick?
Home cooking with her children, living in a farmhouse. Not, I wouldn't say trad wife, although I don't know like what her,
not trad wife, but just like middle, a sustainable middle class.
She's actually a trad single mom right now. Oh.
Interesting.
Well, I would say a pastoral lifestyle, but not like super pastoral. They don't have chickens or anything.
But all your, but you've got other friends from other walks of life who
follow her. I have friends from other walks of life who follow her. And I do talk about it with my best friend. We both talk about her like as if she's like my friend, in the same way that I tell stories about my other friends to my friends. But there's a lot of other people I know that follow her, and I've never ever talked to them about it. I've never said, hey, I saw that you follow such and such influencer. Like, did you know that's actually my friend from camp? Because like, it would never come up because their normie internet habits are almost like, they're kind of like the secret irrelevant habits.
It's like you wouldn't like, if you know, in the old fashioned video store, if you walk into the X-rated video section, you see somebody you know, you're not really going to acknowledge each other.
Well, right. It's funny because it's like that's, but you would think that would be the subterranean stuff that people would be embarrassed by, but that's actually what they signal as their taste.
Well, okay, maybe
that's... And I've literally never been like, hey, do you watch Teffy's videos?
But maybe it's because, like, you are, like, your career is in culture, so you're going to talk about the more subcultural stuff. Where maybe some of your normie friends are talking to their normie friends about this stuff, but they're not talking to you about it because they think you wouldn't be interested.
I think knowing me just qualifies you as a normie. If you've ever met me, like, you're not a normie anymore. Sorry.
I wonder if there's like background context of like, you're not mentioning it by name, but there's like this understanding of, we all know what it is. Like, I don't think I actually like discussed like Mudang with anyone, but I kind of like knew my sisters and my normie friends and my husband like all knew what Mudang was and who Mudang was. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's, or like certain, like, here's another one. Like, everyone on TikTok is eating those pastries that like look like fruit. I forget what it's like. It started in New York, and now every major city has, you know, copycats of these pastries. I don't think I've like explicitly discussed that, but like, I'm sure you guys know what I'm talking about. Other people know what I'm talking about. It's kind of like ambiently there, you know. It's like, and there's little things like that that pop up.
I talked to like Campbell, Jet and Campbell Puckett with a lot of people about, talked about them with a lot of people, talked about Tony P with a lot of people. But that itself was almost like a subcultural thing,
or you know, the girl talking about it. You know that girl Emily that did the salmon bowl?
Yes,
Emily. The only person, yes, the only person I ever talked to about that was my friend Izzy from college in our group chat. She was like, "Did you guys know that's like kind of my good friend in San Francisco?"
And I'm sure you read like three of the cut pieces about it, right?
Well, yeah, or like or ignored them. Like, it never came up with my other friends, but like it came up because my friend was like, "Did you know that's kind of my good friend?" And we were all like, "No, we didn't know that's kind of your good friend in San Francisco." Like she was at like her wedding or something. So, and I feel like that's
so similar to the, or something like that.
The influencer that's my camp friend, like normie media only becomes relevant if somebody has a relationship to it that's deeper than like that kind of ambient gloss that it provides. Otherwise it's like my relationship to it isn't even worth mentioning because my relationship to it is so passive that I feel like it doesn't even say anything about it.
Well, I think this was another headline from one of your recent newsletters or an older one that like the internet is a private part of your body, which I really liked.
Yeah. Don't touch me there. Yeah, that show me on the doll, the doll of the internet where they touched you.
That was an interesting thing because it was so I do these ethnographic interviews of how people use the internet, and you know, something that comes up a lot is like problematic internet usage and like why weren't my parents able to intervene, and it's because there's something so cerebral and private about it. Like, even when you're not doing anything wrong, I think there's a sense of like intimacy with like your browser history, right? There's something very personal about your internet use, even when it's revealed not
preferences, as we often talk about on here.
And so it makes it really difficult and like embarrassing to like seek help if you need it, or like for parents to intervene if their children are doing things that are hurting them, because there is like a unspoken privacy.
Well, I remember one time my husband's like Reddit is tied to his Google Chrome, his Google account, which is tied to some of our subscriptions. So if he logs me into a subscription on my computer, then sometimes it logs me into his Gmail and apparently like his Reddit. And like, so I went to go to Reddit and I was logged in as my husband. I was like, here's the moment that I'm going to realize my husband's doing weird stuff on Reddit. Like, I got scared because you hear these horror stories, and it was literally like, he had posted twice in 10 years, once in like the Spurs subreddit and once in like Call of Duty. And like, who knows what he's passively consuming, but it was just like the most innocent, predictable Reddit behavior, and I was like, wow, like, marked safe.
Okay, you know. one last thing I want to ask. Friend of the pod, Nick Soucy, tweeted earlier today, the dominant aspirational identity in American culture for the past decade was blank. And then dominant aspirational identity for American culture for the next that next decade will be blank. And you retweeted this. So I'm curious what you would fill that out with.
Okay. So I was going to say something, but I already felt like that's wrong. What I was about to say.
We could be wrong on here.
I think that it was the poster, maybe not for, it wasn't the dominant one, but I think for a certain subset of people, like, I think we're exiting the like internet celebrity, right? And that could be poster, it could be, you know, TikTok star, whatever. There's many different iterations of that. And it will be, I mean, I don't know. I am like bullish that, like, you know, as Sean Monahan has also like predicted, like, in-person scenes is where the locus of coolness and, you know, maybe even monetary gain is right now and will continue to be. So maybe something like that, if that answered the question clearly.
I think that's true. I mean, I actually think I would fill in both blanks with to be turned into a cartoon, because like if you were turned into a cartoon on like The Simpsons in the early 2000s, like that is the peak of fame. If you're an intellectual and you get a New Yorker portrait or a stippled Wall Street Journal illustration, that is the height of your power. And now it's like you got to be turned into like a Pepe the Frog. But there's something.
What was it?
Pepe, whatever his name is, you know who I'm talking about, that fucking frog. So anyway, like, I've like, it's like, why is the height of success in America to be turned into a cartoon, whether that's you're on the point. Left or the right? I don't see it changing anytime soon. Although now you probably have like a meme coin too.
You know, I was jealous of the, speaking of the Hegelian e-girls, to do a callback. I'm like, she got a Wojak. I don't have a Wojak. I want a Wojak.
We need a Catherine Dolphin Wojak. Somebody listening, if you could make Wojaks, make that. I would say it's like, when I first saw this, my thought was just like, for both of them, entrepreneur, but in like a very broad sense, where like a content creator is an entrepreneur, a sports gambler is an entrepreneur. Like, I've just read those two recent reviews of the Eric Baker book, like How Entrepreneurship Exhausted America. So that's been really heavily on my mind the past couple of weeks. But I would say, for both of them, it's either just entrepreneur or just rich, which is kind of boring because it's like I'm supposed to engage with a more specific identity there, I know. But that's what I would put.
Everyone wants to be rich except for rich people. The rich people want to be cool.
That's they still want to be rich, though.
They're doing really
well.
Yeah,
they definitely don't want to be poor.
Yeah. Cool. I think we'll end it there. This has been Tasteland. Thank you for coming on.
See you next week.
Peace.